President.
Is it better if I speak Spanish or English? Whatever you prefer. I worked so hard for this.
Good evening, the Haverim Revitans. I'd like to thank Rabbi Shulman for asking me to chair the session and coming all the way from St. Louis. It's really a pleasure to be together with Haverim, and I just would want to say at the beginning that one can look at the small group that we have and perhaps wonder where everyone else is, but then again we can look at the small group and in a sense express a certain gratitude in that we can not only get to know each other a little bit, for those that don't know each other, and I'm looking at some faces of young Rabbanim who I don't know that well, but also it's really an opportunity to get to schmooze in a more informal way with some of the Tamidei Chachamim that have been asked to give the shiurim over these past few days, and of course this evening, Rav Rosenzweig in particular, who will be giving the session. So I think we can view this as a wonderful opportunity to perhaps ask the sort of questions and engage in the sort of dialogue that sometimes large numbers make a little bit difficult. So with that, let me just introduce Rav Rosenzweig with and the topic that he's going to be speaking about, which has been entitled the Tzelem Elokim, right to privacy and mutual respect. The pasuk in the parasha that we will read next Shabbos, when the Malachim come to Avram and ask about the whereabouts of Sarah, Vayomer Elo Vayei Sarah Ishtecha Vayomer Hinei Va'oel, so we know what Rashi says, that this was an opportunity for the Malachim to increase, to enable Avram to increase the love that undoubtedly he had for Sarah, his wife. But as the Gemara says, that Avram would once again appreciate this wonderful virtue that Sarah Imenu had, that she was Snua. I recall hearing Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal define snua as something more than simply a technical matter of dress and even a speech, but the Rav would often speak about a tsunua, whether it refers to a man or a woman, as referring to a certain nobility, a certain very special uniqueness in a person's character that very often is hidden, something that no matter how well we think we know a person, we never know a person quite that well. I can recall the Rav speaking at a convention such as Rabbinic Alumni years and years ago, when he said you could be married and have a wonderful marriage for many, many, many years, and by definition, you will never, never, never know your spouse completely. Because there's an aspect of tznius, which is the hidden uniqueness of an individual that sometimes is so mystical in the sense that it's almost impossible to tap it completely. And the fact that we know that every individual contains that element of tznius means that there is something about everyone that we need to respect and that we need to grant a certain element of privacy. So just with that, perhaps opening comments in the parasha, it really is with a great deal of pleasure that I was asked to introduce Rabbi Rosenzweig. I mean, you'll take a look at the Chavrusa, which I briefly looked at, where there is a special article here congratulating Rabbi Rosenzweig upon being appointed the Rosh Kollel of the Henry Barron Institute of Higher Talmudic Studies at the Yeshiva. Of course, those of us, it's no surprise for those of us who have gotten to know Rabbi Rosenzweig over the years and listening to his shiurim, my community was very fortunate in having him come and to be a scholar in residence. We've had his wife, Smadar, more than once to St. Louis to speak. So to us, it was sort of a given that eventually Rabbi Rosenzweig would ultimately achieve this incredible distinguished appointment that he has. to say that he is one of the most exceptional Talmidei Chachamim that we have at our yeshiva, and that he's able to articulate some of the real, real problems that Rabbanim face in our shuls and in the community is something that we know because we've heard him speak on numerous, numerous topics. So it's really with a great deal of pleasure and personal privilege that I call upon Rabbi Rosenzweig to address us on this important topic this evening.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Neufeld. I appreciate the warm words, and I also like the formulation about tzniut. It almost makes me feel as if I have nothing more to say, because that's really a very nice. It's a nice way to define the topic. There was a little bit of confusion in the topic of my shiur or my lecture this evening. Originally it was supposed to be one thing, and then I think it was in between stages became Benish Shalishto, and then it got back to privacy. But since it was a little bit of Benish Shalishto in the intermediate Bain, it was Benish Shalishto, so I'll try to say something about that aspect of the topic as well. The topic of the talk this evening is the concept of privacy, responsibility, and personal integrity as dimensions of human dignity and sanctity. Or one could sum all that up, perhaps, with two words, Tzelem Elokim. While Tzelem Elokim is generally portrayed by Chazal and by the Targums and by others in terms of a kind of creativity and certain level of majesty, being a shalit, or the exercise of control over the lives of others, in that sense, man imitates God, the Tzelem Elokim. Ironically, the same concept of Tzelem Elokim also entails humility, b'mokom atamotze gdulaso, atamotze anvasamuso, surrender to a higher authority, the concept of tzimtzum, contraction, or again, the awareness and the capacity to withdraw when man knows that he's reached a point which is beyond his jurisdiction. That too is a form of both imitation, B'Tzelem Elokim, the Ribbono Shel Olam himself created the world with Tzimtzum, and in some cases, and that's the dialectic of Tzimtzum, to know when not to imitate, and when to withdraw, and when the imitation ends. But in addition to that, Tzelem Elokim also includes a measure, at least, of mystery and of mystique. Again, in the sense of imitatio Dei, Kel mistater b'shachri ochevion, ha-sechal ha-nelam mikol ha-ra'ayon. We're told that Shirashirim's uniqueness as representing not only Kodesh, but Kodesh HaKadashim. The question is why? Some of the Mepharshim explain precisely because of all the imagery, because of the difficulty of penetrating the actual pshat, because there's more that is beneath the surface than on the surface. Because of that, it represents Kodesh HaKadashim. Kodesh HaKadashim is that which is inaccessible, that which is private, that which is hidden, that in which the mystique shines through. If one can speak about a mystique shining through, that of course is the irony itself. So what I'd like to do is to analyze this idea of privacy or the mystique of man, or at least how it's reflected in a practical area, the concept of privacy and of confidentiality. And to try to say briefly, it's a huge topic, and I don't think there's a possibility of actually covering the details of it, but at least in terms of the basic principles, what the concept is and what its limits are. And we begin, of course, simply by noting that the dialectic between the two notions of Tzelem Elokim, the creative and the majestic and the controlling side on the one hand, and the mystique and the surrender and the contraction on the other, is precisely what gives man his singularity, and of course it's that singularity which feeds his ability to be this kind of creative individual on the one hand, and which also demands that he protect his individuality and his mystique through some concept of privacy on the other. So the relationships are complex, but the relationships are also extremely, extremely clear. Let me begin by analyzing the relationship between confidentiality and privacy, just again to establish the basic parameters. To briefly illustrate the point, we need to do no more than simply refer, unfortunately, to current events. The recent scandal in the Clinton presidency, in which, ironically, on one hand you have a very strong assertion of executive privilege and concepts of confidentiality, on the one hand, at the same time, tremendously embarrassing public disclosures, certainly on some level gratuitous public disclosures, on the other. We live in a society in which there is this grotesque imbalance between the values of privacy on the one hand and of professional confidentiality on the other. A cursory glance at any measure or any barometer of cultural or societal norms, and that's, I refer to the best and the worst, not only the talk shows, but even the most respected news programs, the print media, not only the tabloids, but the New York Times, and the most prestigious news magazines, reveals that standards of sneers, specifically in respect, in the sense of the concept of privacy or dignity of others, even the respect of privacy itself, it's not others disclosing about third parties, but people simply bearing their souls in ways that are, from our perspective, I think, extremely troubling, the tell-all disclosures of relatively respectable public figures has been completely eroded in recent years. Even the hardly rigorous standards of dignity and of privacy, even simply of what we would call good taste, that were operative in years past in the Western world, even a decade ago, have become the exception rather than the rule. And yet, at the same time, the legal protection that is accorded confidentiality, particularly in the professions, lawyers, journalists, medical professionals, even the confidentiality of social service agencies and their records, which in some cases plays an important, sometimes very destructive role, we'll get to that in just a minute, is extremely exaggerated in our society. While the island of privacy afforded by professional confidentiality is generally very admirable, I don't want there to be any confusion on that, occasionally it can assume grotesque proportions when that confidentiality is exploited or applied in an uncritical, absolute way without any regard to the consequences, often shielding criminal behavior or contributing to the victimization of the innocent. The all-too-frequent headline stories of the last number of years of the abuses, the murder of innocent children as a result of abuse, defenseless children, whose confidential records were sealed or couldn't be compromised, even situations where there was some suspicion that that there might be harm that might come to them, tragically illustrates this phenomenon of this imbalance. Unquestionably, halakha would not have countenanced, does not countenance, such a hideous application of confidentiality, even though the concept of confidentiality in almost all other circumstances is viewed as a very noble one, as long as it's applied with wisdom. It's my contention that the imbalance created between and the disentanglement of a formal and inflexible confidentiality on the one hand, for a broader perspective which gives confidentiality its significance and its halakhic basis regarding integrity, dignity, what I call Selam Elokim, including a fundamental commitment to and an appreciation of the innate value of privacy, which should but doesn't always serve as the basis of confidentiality, is precisely what is at root of these abuses. That these tragedies partially relate to excessive confidentiality, even at a time, as I say, where the president's behavior, every detail, is public record, and the public is obsessed, you know, with the private lives of O.J. Simpson and Prince Charles, again captures this very disturbing incongruity. The total lack of privacy on the one hand, the overstatement of and over-exercise of confidentiality on the other hand. Precisely because confidentiality in halakhic terms is, I think, simply a subcategory of an ambitious, demanding privacy rooted in a particular conceptual orientation, which I'll describe. It must be measured, and it must only be applied against its internal value yardstick. That which motivates the halakhically ambitious aspect or demand of privacy and confidentiality also, in other words, must establish its limits and its contours. Thus, confidentiality is less absolutely formidable as an independent value in halakha than it is in the Western world, but ironically, far more impressive, far more effective and central in promoting human dignity and sanctity and in protecting individuals as a result. And I would add that confidentiality and privacy within the family structure is a particularly compelling theme in light of all of this, and I'll elaborate soon. Indeed, the condition of confidentiality appears to be basically, all things being equal, implicit and automatic according to the halacha. The Gemara Yuma Das Daud of the Beis speaks, and I'll quote the Gemara soon, speaks about the idea that a certain person hears something, he should assume that he is under some sort of confidentiality commitment, even if it's not explicated. To be sure, if there is an additional explicit or in some cases professional commitment to confidentiality, that adds an important dimension to the privacy protection that will be afforded. Firstly, it establishes unequivocally that there is greater urgency perceived in this particular confidence. Secondly, the commitment itself heightens the issue of personal integrity. A person makes a commitment to keep something confident, to keep a confidence, that obviously his own integrity is on the line, in addition to the objective norms that would militate against his revealing or disclosing something that he's not supposed to reveal. Thirdly, this commitment may pose formal, and in some cases formidable, legal, here I mean legal halachic, obstacles to the violation of such a confidence. These may need to be addressed, even in situations where there are sufficient halachic grounds to overcome that commitment. In other words, if the halacha demands that one violate this confidentiality commitment, there still needs to be some grappling with the commitment itself. The issue of shavua obviously comes to mind, particularly complex when you consider that there are various types of shavuos, and that some are binding, even when they include what's known in the category of nishba levatos hamitzvah, that addressed by the Mishnah towards the end of the third paragraph of Shavuos. Nishba levatos hamitzvah, what happens? Nishba levatos hamitzvah de kolel, and there are two types of kolels, kolel mefurash, kolel klali. In other words, the person who takes a broader shavua, the person who takes a shavua is simply levatos hamitzvah, so the Mishnah says that shavua is null and void. If his commitment is included in a broader commitment, most of which or part of which does not entail any kind of violation, then in certain circumstances it's binding. So when you have a kolel, klali, or mefurash, depending on the principles that govern those halakhic categories, one perhaps needs to address the shvua, even if on other halakhic grounds it's been established that one has the right, in some cases one has the obligation, to violate his commitment. Ironically, the issue has implications even for psulei edus. Sometimes one is halakhically mandated, or one theoretically would be halakhically mandated, to overcome or to set aside a commitment that he makes. At the same time, since it may involve him in certain other violations, ironically, he may be disqualified as an aid, for example, because of the violation which he had to overcome, an issue which the Piskei Tshuva speaks about in Chol Shemishpat. If indeed a confidant then is in violation, even if we're supportive of his breach of his commitment, the question is, what is the impact of that breach, and whether or not he has not been rendered ineffective as a result of being entangled in all of this. I said Piskei Tshuva, others speak about it in Siman Aleph Daled, in Chol Shemishpat. In any case, the question of confidentiality, especially in situations where halacha demands that one breach the confidentiality, needs to be confronted in our era as professionals take these kind of confidentiality oaths almost routinely as part of their licensing, as part of their initiation, the Hippocratic Oath and other things come to mind. Furthermore, professional commitments are characterized by another complicating factor. The broader impact on institutions and the wider implications for providing critical services to a total community. Should one jeopardize, for example, the benefits of psychological counseling by rarely disclosing urgent information in certain cases in order to protect a patient or a third party? Even if one could justify such a disclosure, again, very complex halakhic issue, the question one would have to deal with is not merely the narrow case, but what impact does this have on the whole institution of psychological counseling, which certainly is beneficial for the total community, if there's no reliance on confidentiality, and what broader impact is that going to have? So the weighing of the narrow case versus the wider implications is something that needs to be considered as well. The decision then to violate a confidence, even when legitimized, even when mandated in the narrow case, in terms of the value of privacy and confidentiality, needs to calculate, obviously, the wider impact and consequences. However, while each of these issues is important, deserving and requiring independent treatment, none of this alters the fact that primarily confidentiality has its roots in the concept of privacy and dignity. And for this reason, confidentiality's application is going to be subject to the broader values that underlie that principle of human dignity. Kavod HaBriyos, Kedushas HaYochid, V'ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh L'Zeh, etc. These, of course, being the foundation for this concept of dignity and privacy. Let me briefly assess the centrality and the pervasiveness of privacy in certain halachic areas, as well as some of the values at stake, just to give you a broader picture. First thing to note is that on some level, at least, man's domain is viewed by halacha as some sort of inner sanctum, and a sacrosanct asylum of some sort as well. Again, symbolically, this has important implications for the family unit, because we're not simply speaking about the family residence, one's home, although we're also speaking about that. But if we speak about one's home, then kal v'chomer ben b'no shel kal v'chomer, certainly we're speaking about the inner sanctum of the family unit. That, of course, being a bastion which should be protected even at great risk, and sometimes when one needs to compromise other values. I'll speak about that as we go along. The juxtaposition of Sukkim at the very end of Shemos with the beginning of Vayikra lead Chazal to an interesting conclusion. After all, in the end of Shemos we're told, V'lo yachol Moshe lavo el ol moed, ki shachein alav ha'anan. Moshe Rabbeinu was not allowed to enter into the inner sanctum. But in Vayikra we're told, Vayikra Hashem el Moshe, Vayibaber elav me'ohel moed lemar. Somehow, he was able to achieve this dialogue, even though that implied that he entered, that he passed the threshold of the inner sanctum. The Medrash Lekach tells us, Mikan lo yikanes adam lebeis chavero, elam kein yomar lo yikanes, kal v'chomer mimoshe. If Moshe Rabbeinu, right, was not able, and the word the matir was used, and we were speaking before the beginning of the session, if Moshe Rabbeinu needed a matir to enter that threshold, then certainly every other individual needs it. This applies even with respect to one's own physical home and within the precincts of one's own family. Gemara Mitzachim, Daf Kuf Yudeis, and Aleph tells us, Amar Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yeshua Beno, again, he was addressing his son. Bni, al tikanes lebeischa pitom, don't simply burst in to your home. Kol shkein lebeischa bercha. Certainly, one has to respect the precincts of his neighbor. This value is deemed so important, and as everybody knows, the theme is incorporated literally into the big day Kohen Gadol itself. This sensitivity is considerably extended to a legal right by the Torah Shebichtav and by the Torah Shebaalpeh. The Psukim in Dvarim Chaf Dalid, Sukim Yud and Yud Aleph, Kisashe, Vrayacha, Masas Numa, Lo Savol, Beso, Lavot, Avuto, Achutz Tamod, Vaisha Sharatano Shebo, Yotzi Elecha, Esa Avut, Achutza. When it comes to debt collection, it appears that there are limits. And again, we have to understand the case. We're talking about an individual who has rights. He lent money, this is an act of chesed. He has every right to collect that money, and yet limitations are imposed upon him in terms of the inner sanctum, the home, invading the home of the debtor. The Gemara Bava Metzia Daf Kufid Gimel Amud Beis, according to the simple reading of the Gemara in any case, registers the view that perhaps one should distinguish between the noshe, between the creditor, who has no right to enter the inner precinct of the debtor, and the Shliach Bezdin. After all, Shliach Bezdin already is the arm of Bezdin itself. Hefker Bezdin. Hefker Bezdin has the right to invade a private domain in order to guarantee that the collection process will be efficient. But the fact is that in the Gemara itself, it's also clear, even with regard to Shliach Bezdin, that the matter is not so simple, and there are deos in the Gemara that say even Shliach Bezdin has no right to enter into such a private domain. The Rambam in Uchsmav of Lova, Per Deis Halacha Beis, the Shulchan Aruch in the Rambam's wake, paskin that even Shliach Bezdin has this limitation. So even when we're talking about deflecting an otherwise legitimate process, and again, I emphasize, a process which is not just the right or the prerogative of the creditor, right, but the whole system of chesed, you know, lending money is one of the highest forms of tzedakah. And the whole hierarchy of chesed really rests upon this very basic consideration. And we have numerous halachos of Lotino Delos and Shulabin, right, in order to ensure that a free access of credit, free access to credit, will always exist within the Jewish community. And yet, with all the roots in chesed, these significant limitations are imposed. Of course, while this is true, those limitations are also not without boundaries. That's one area. Disclosing secrets or private information, quite a radically different area. I'm actually choosing things that are very, very different in their nature and orientation, simply to establish how pervasive this concept is. Now, it's not limited to any one particular area. It's not Kosher Mishpat, it's not Yoredeya, it's everything. Pasuk in Mishlei, of course, Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk in Gimel, links the concept of disclosure of secrets as well as the concept of private information. And in its positive formulation, the Pasuk appears to extend to all private matters. Halech Rachil Megalesod Neman Ruach Mechased Davar. A real Neman Ruach is a person who is involved in Mechased Davar, in covering up, or at least in shielding, that which should not be made public. This pasuk is the basis for the Mishnah's conclusion in Sanhedrin, Daf Chafetz Amud Aleph, that deliberating Dayanim should not reveal their advocacy. You have a Din Torah, and various Dayanim side with different views, and ultimately Psak Din emerges. The various Dayanim should not reveal which position, who took which position. He shouldn't reveal that he was the minority judge, but he was overruled. And again, you can understand that it's not just a question of Tama Dayanim. We're talking about people of stature and people of integrity. Why would he reveal such a thing? Not simply for the Lashon Hara. Undoubtedly, because he felt he had a strong conviction that, you know, the fellow Dayanim didn't adhere to his position, and they overruled him. And he felt, as a matter of the public record, as a matter of conviction, that he wanted on the record that his view was different, even though he was outvoted. Nonetheless, the principle is, Al Zeh Nemar, Lo Telech Rachil Ba'amecha, the Omer, Holech Rachil, Megalesot. The Gemara later on in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph, records that a student observer, not even a member of the Bezdin, But a student observer of the Din Torah, of the Shaka V'Tayya of that Din Torah, who disclosed the information even 22 years later, long after the presumably the statute of limitations on revealing secrets in most cultures at least would have ended. This individual was banned from the Beis Medrash. He was officially branded, and we can almost visualize it. A megalosot. Ahu Talmuda, the Nafik Alei Kala, the Gali Milsa, the Itmar Ben Midrasha, Basar Esrin Vitartin Shnin, after 22 years, Afke Rav Amin Ben Midrasha, he threw him out of the Beis Medrash, Amar, Dain Gali Razia. Here is a discloser of secrets. And while Rashi and the Smag link this Gemara and this idea to some concept of Lashon Hara, it's interesting to note that the Rambam and the Sanhedrin, Perek Chavdeis HaMachazayin, and the Yad Ramah do not tie this event to Lashon Hara. They think that per se, revealing private information constitutes grounds for this kind of severe reaction. Rabbeinu Yonah in the Shari Tshuva, Chela Gimel, Reish Kothei, explicitly formulates that this is separate and distinct from Lashon Hara. V'chayev ha'adam l'hastir ha'soda sher yigale elav chavero, a person is obligated to keep confidences and secrets, things that were revealed to him, derech seser, apapi she'ein begilui ha'soda hu inyan rechilos, even if the revelation does not constitute what we would normally call Lashon Hara. In the course of its continuation, interestingly, according to at least one perspective that he advances, he links this concept with Sneas. The Hashenis Kimigala Sod Ach Yetse Nigedar Hatsneas. Vihine Hu Mavir Aldas Balhasod. Ramar Shlomo Alav Ashalom Golesod Halech Rachil. Again, the nobility that you spoke of so nicely earlier, which is the foundation stone for the concept of tzniut, that dignity has been stripped away from this individual, even if there's no Lashon Hara, no rechilus, as we normally translate it, involved. Okay. This Gemara then implies not only a prohibition, but validates sanctions that are to be applied against the offender. In the Tshuvas of the Ranach, or the Leo ben Chayin Mikushta, this idea of consequences is explicitly developed. Brings there a case of one of the Tovei HaKahal, again they would have a community board, one of the Balabatim, essentially, who ran the community, who revealed again the quiet or the private deliberations of the body, and who was disqualified from any kind of future decision-making role in the community, since he lost his public trust status, again, invoking this very Gemara in Sanhedrin. Perhaps there's another basis for the prohibition, one again which extends privacy to implicit confidentiality, and that's the Gemara in Yuma, Avdalah Beis, I referred to earlier. Ad sheyomar lo leich emar, unless you are explicitly given permission, license, a matir, to reveal, minayin ma'omer davar l'chaveru shehu b'bal yomar, the default position is that you have no right to reveal. Shenemar, again quoting by Yikra Aleph Aleph, by Daber Hashem El Moshe Lemar. Again, Moshe was only given this license by the Rabbanu Shlomo. And again, while the She'iltos of Ramachai Gaon, Chavches is the number of the She'ilta, and the Smag in Lav and Tes, the Magen Avraham, Arachayim, Kuf Nun Vav, consistently link this and other themes with Lashon Hara, because they assume that if there's some serious infraction involved in revealing this kind of confidence, it must be that the confidence itself reflects some damaging information, etc. But the simple reading of these Makaros and the understanding of other Rishonim is clear, and that is the concept of confidentiality or privacy per se. Indeed, the Chafetz Chaim, in his monumental work, Shmiras HaLashon, in the section on Rechilos, Ches Hei, understands it, perceives it this way as well. It's completely unrelated to a content of Lashon Hara. Significantly, there are two girsos in the Mishnah itself. Mishnah Chavtet. If the pasuk in Vayikra, Yudtes Tazayin, Lo Telech Rachil Be'anecha, which is associated with Lashon Hara, and is often linked, you know, together with the Gimel Averus of Yehareg Vayavar, maybe not literally, but even at least symbolically, in terms of its weight and its significance, associated with the case of Miriam, etc., is this very pasuk, Lo Telech Rachil Be'anecha, is this the source of this Issa, which obviously would give it even greater stature? So what we have here is an indication of these girsos of a major debate, if that pasuk of Lo Telech Rachil Be'anecha is limited to pejorative or detrimental or damaging information. This is implied by the Yerushalmi, should add, Yerushalmi and Teya, Aleph Aleph, Yerushalmi and Suvas also seems to suggest this, or relates simply, again, to disclosing information which one was not given permission to disclose, in other words, violations of confidentiality. It would be very striking, given the context and the association of this pasuk, if, with defamation of character and other, as I say, extremely weighty prohibitions, if this concept of privacy per se were associated with this pasuk. Apparently, we would have to interpret that not only Lashon Hara, which is obvious, character assassination, the detrimental effects of Lashon Hara require no elaboration, but apparently even disclosing private information, revealing something of a person which, in a sense, takes away from his mystique, or simply violates his dignity in any way, or his desire for privacy, itself is interesting. Both of these share one common theme, and that is diminishing Kavod HaBriyos, the Tzelem Elokim, and in a sense, challenging his rights and his singularity as an individual, which includes this component of mystique. Indeed, the invasion of privacy may constitute a primary theme in Lashon Hara itself. I think that could be demonstrated as well, Ein kan makom laharich, but I think that could be established as well. The prohibition to try to uncover private information, even for one's own knowledge, even if one has no intention of sharing it with others, is no different in terms of the violation of privacy from disclosing it to others. Again, in the Halachos Ketanos, we're told, Yesh Isur Levakesh Lechapes Mistorav Shel Chavero, Mali Lo Telech Rachil Lacherim, Mali Lo Telech Rachil Liatzmo. Even more striking is the advice of the Sefer Hasidim, a well-known passage, Tav Samach Aleph, that one should even avoid tefillah in what otherwise might be an optimum place, if it's a place in which one is likely to invade the privacy of others and overhear confidences. Echad dispalel b'chatzach beis haknesses, vayu rashi kol yoshin b'yeshiva. The rashi kol were deliberating at the time when people were gathering for tefillah. Amar lo hachacham mutav lecha l'hitpalel b'bayit, even though it's generally speaking preferred to daven in a synagogue structure. Shema rashi kol medabrim davar she'enim rotzim she'ida adav. Indeed, the whole chair of Ben Gershom should be perceived against this background. It has implications in terms of guaranteeing the privacy of correspondence simply flows from this idea that the Chayrim reinforces an already existing concept, an existing prerogative of every individual, that is his right to privacy implied by Lo Telech Rachil. This legislation of Chayrim Ben Gershom needs to be understood and appreciated in light of the power of Chayrim. Again, this is often lost on us today, because everybody's put in Chayrim today, and it doesn't mean very much either. But if you understood that in the time of Ben Gershom, the medieval autonomous Jewish community, Chayrim destroyed reputations, and equally important, maybe more, destroyed livelihoods, quite literally, the idea that somebody who violated this kind of confidence would be subject to this kind of extreme penalty is significant indeed. In the Maram Tfus Prag source of Rabbeinu Gershom, the implication is that a correspondence, if discarded, can be read. But it's interesting that many Achronim extend Rabbeinu Gershom's cherem even to those correspondences that have been discarded. Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz, again in the Samachos Ketanos, who writes a lot about these topics, notes that the sender, the person who writes the correspondence, he may be makbid. And again, even if there's no content of Lashon Hara, we're simply talking about revealing that which was not meant for public view, that in itself constitutes a violation of the cherem. Again, an extension which reflects the severity with which this is held. Again, in the Tshuvas of the Chidkei Lev, Yoridei Simin Mem Tes, you find the ruling that a recipient of a correspondence has no right to share it with others. Never mind one which is discarded, but the recipient of the correspondence, you might argue that he has been given an implicit license since it was revealed to him, so implicitly it's his good judgment or bad judgment, as the case may be, whether he wants to share it with others. But there are, as I say, achronim who suggest that even if it contains nothing that is superficially damaging to the other party, simply on the basis of that Gemara and Yuma, the Abdallah of the Days, if there's no matir, then the recipient doesn't have implicit license to share with others. An interesting question. Perhaps the most striking manifestation of all, the Torah's central view of privacy, is the concept of Hezek Re'iya, which of course establishes privacy as mazik in some sense. And I'm assuming the more mainstream view, which is that Hezek Re'iya is not simply or primarily rooted in loss of value or limitation of use of property, views which have echoes in some of the positions of Rishonim and Achronim, Ravid and position of the Sma, or that it really constitutes a serious direct violation based on some mystical understanding of Ayin Ra, which may as well. But according to the preponderance view of Hezek Re'iya, which focuses simply on tznius and privacy and quality of life per se. This concept of tznius, or this foundation of tznius, is the basis for Hezek Re'iya, and the transcendent perspective that it implies is clearly indicated by the Makor. After all, the Gemara Bava Basra, the Samech Amin Aleph, when it relates to Hezek Re'iya, quotes the psukim in Bamidbar, Bayaris Yisrael, Shochem L'Shvatav, right in the Parsha of Bilam, Matavu Alecha Yaakov, Mishkin Osecha Yisrael. Not only is invasion of privacy prohibited, but its very potential, the fact that I might fear the invasion of privacy in my own domain, that needs to be precluded as well, in order to ensure a certain quality of life. True privacy is contingent not merely upon safeguarding my secrets or my privacy, but it's contingent upon a sense of security, being able to assume that no one is going to invade my privacy. And the actual nitty-gritty dinim of Hezek Re'iya reflect that issue of security in particular. The fact that this is defined as Hezek Re'iya, is extremely revealing, right? Not only a right, not only a prerogative, but this matter of tznius turns into the most basic concept of all, the concept of mazik. It's especially important to keep in mind that Hezek Re'iya halachos restrict the individual in his own domain, in his own property. I am not allowed to engage in behavior in my dalet amos, in my dinei mamonos, because of the potential invasion of privacy that it may result in for my neighbor. Talking about building windows and the need to build fences, etc. That's a remarkable limitation, and when you couple that together with the idea of Hezek, that if I refuse to limit my own behavior, my own conduct, and my own property, and that constitutes a Hezek for someone else, we're doubly impressed, I think, with the uniqueness of the halachic perspective in all of this. According to the Ramban, the famous formulation, Ramban Bava Basra Daf Nun Tes Amud Aleph, Hezek Re'iya is not subject to chazaka, which means that if somebody were to engage in this kind of behavior, that his window would be open to somebody else's privacy for a certain amount of time, so under normal circumstances, one might assume that that would establish a chazaka. meaning apparently the other fellow is not mocked, he's not insistent upon this privacy requirement. It doesn't affect his quality of life, or he's willing to waive that that right that he has, and consequently you should be able to continue your behavior, keep your open window, etc. According to the Ramban, there is no chazaka when it comes to hezek ri'ah. Why? According to one formulation, because hezek ri'ah is in the category of nizkei adam ba'adam. Imishum ayin ra, imishum lishna bisha, imishum tsniusa. The last, I think, being even the most impressive of the three. The very notion of nizkei adam ba'adam on the basis of a violation of tsnius precisely underscores that tsnius is not just a nice thing, it's not just a yoredeya thing. We're speaking about Chesh Nishpat now. It has to do with the very diminishing of the human being himself. One is literally taking apart a person when one violates his tsnius in this way. The fact that there is no price tag that one can attach to this principle of hezek ri'ah, another point that the Ramban makes, also reflects this idea. It's Chosha Mishpat, transcends Chosha Mishpat. It's Yoredeya, but it extends into Chosha Mishpat. The Rambam's view, in Ilchos Shchenim, Parak Aleph Halacha Beis, Parak Zayin Halacha Vav, Parak Yid Aleph Halacha Dalet, while not going as far as the formulation of the Ramban, does equate hezek ri'ah with what the Gemara calls Kitra Beis Hakisei. Kitra being an incinerator, Beis Hakisei being a sewer or a dump. Ein dat adam sovelet otam. These represent intolerable encroachments on the quality of the individual's life. And it would never be assumed that a chazaka could be established for such a thing. The Rambam assumes that hezek ri'ah, the invasion of privacy, is on that level. The equation of one's desire, one's interest in privacy, with the presence of a limitation on the chotzer of one's yard, in one's inner sanctum, inside one's home, and from the incursion, not of one's neighbor, but of Rishus HaRabim, of the general public, and with respect to the intentional spying of one individual on the conduct of another. It's clear in the Rishonim, particularly the Rimigash and the Adrama, but others as well, that there's absolutely no debate that when it comes to these areas, that this constitutes a violation and that hezek ri'ah shma hezek. The implications, again, for the family structure, not merely the physical domain, I think are clear. And the implications are not just that the family structure requires extra protection in terms of its privacy, but that it requires extra protection in particular from the general public out there, something which I think is an important theme that Rabbanim need to confront, and if I have time, I will try to speak a little bit more about it. The key to unraveling of the mystery of hezek ri'ah, how could tsnius turn into nezek, is the puzzling, or apparently puzzling, application of the obligation that neighbors who are not involved in this act of hezek, their responsibility to protect their fellow neighbor from the invasion of privacy that comes from Rishus HaRabim. The Gemara in Bava Basra, that based on the base, indicates that hezek ri'ah applies even if I am not invading my neighbor's privacy, but simply my responsibility to prevent anshei Rishus HaRabim from invading also may play a role. How could that be? The answer is, I think, I don't have time to develop it in too much depth, the Mishnah in Bava Basra, Dav Zayin Amud Beis, which speaks about the relationship between Shechenim and citizens. The Mishnah establishes that citizens who live in a certain town have all sorts of mutual obligations, reciprocal obligations. The Gemara and the Mishnah implicitly seem to link hezek ri'ah with that concept. On the surface, it's startling. If I live in a town and I want certain privileges, it's evident that I have to make certain concessions. It's a social contract that applies. What does that have to do with hezek ri'ah? Apparently, what the Gemara is telling us is that the foundation of the hezek ri'ah, of invasion of privacy, which emerges as nezek, is precisely the background of Hilchos Shechinah. All the dinim of Hezekiah and the Rambam are found in Hilchos Shechinah. The idea here is that because the Torah demands a certain high level of interaction between neighbors, we don't look at the potential nezek in a vacuum, simply beginning with the action itself. We look at it against the background and the foundation of expectations and mutual and reciprocal interrelationships. And if there is a Shechinin community, namely a community based on mutual interest and mutual respect, and that has impact in areas of equal rights, citizen rights, etc., if all that is true, then when you violate the expectations, the norms that have come to be considered basic to that relationship, then you haven't simply violated those norms. What you've done is that you've violated nezek. In other words, mazik can be a function not merely of the objective severity or stature of the action itself, but it can be a destruction of the foundation of the relationship, which gives greater significance to that breach. Mashal l'mad davar doma, just very briefly, the Rambam has a famous shita, well known in Hilchos Shomrin, Rambam Perek Beis of Chasidus Halacha Gimel, develops the idea of posheya kemazik. Rambam explains that a shomer chinam is chayev b'pshia, but not because that's the only kabbalah shmira, the only hiskaibus which we can impose upon him. Rather, says the Rambam, the point is that every pshia of a shomer chinam is a kind of mazik, posheya kemazik. All the achronim bothered by this Rambam. After all, if you look objectively at the standard of mazik that apply in Kol HaTorah Kula, you'll find that this is very tenuous at best. Namely, it might be garmi, it might be grama. It's too far removed. There are too many other parties involved. Is posheya, is a person who's negligent, really a mazik? The answer is objectively he's not. But the Rambam didn't say that Poshea was a mazik in Hilchos Nuskei Mamon. The Rambam said that Poshea was a mazik in Hilchos Schirus. Namely, given the context, given the background, given the hischaibus that this shomer made, and the anticipation on behalf of the mafkid that his object is in good hands, in secure hands, given all of that, negligence constitutes mazik. The same action wouldn't be mazik if we started from ground zero, not in Hilchos Schirus or in Hilchos Shechinim, but in Hilchos Nuskei Mamon. In which case, the concept of privacy emerges as simply reflecting the foundation of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh, of Yahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, etc. All the citizens obligated to maintain and to preserve the quality of life of other citizens, the innate right of one to turn into the legal commitment of the other, which if neglected becomes or constitutes mazik. That this process could apply only to the innate right of privacy reveals the primary and inherent quality of that concept of tznius. Bilam realized that this constituted the basis literally for hashra'as hashchina, for kedusha sushana, as it is, I say, the basis for again, I would add, it's clear that mutual commitment of family members and the concomitant expectations from family members internally within the family unit enhance this theme within the family structure. Again, the anticipation of privacy and confidentiality and a mutual support in terms of quality of life is all the greater, and the breach is all the more unacceptable. Moreover, it's the fusion between individual development and uniqueness, privacy, in other words, as a transcendent and innate value on the one hand, and the concomitant commitment to one's fellow, to your neighbor, which guarantees that privacy right on the other, as hezek. And that, I think, emerges as a unique halachic perspective, not only on privacy, But privacy reflects the unique halakhic perspective on law and man generally in this brief, in this small issue. This view is reflected also in the Tshuva of the Rajba. Rajba in the Tshuva, Chelek Beis, Reish, Samach, Ches, suggests that Hezekriah is not subject to Mechila. You cannot wave away your prerogative of Hezekriah, because it defines the uniqueness, the literally defining characteristic of Kol Yisrael. A wonderful formulation of the Rajba. Mikol makom im nagu shalola hakpit klal al hezek ria she'ala batim b'chaterot minag b'ta'utu. It's an improper minag. Minag b'ta'ut. Ain't a minag. She'ain mechilas ha'akpada ela b'mamonos. You can wave away your rights in dine mamonos. She'adam rashay li tena shalo lizak b'nechasa avalei no rashay lifrot gedaron shel Yisrael. You cannot breach the definition, the core and essence of what Klal Yisrael is all about. The shalom lihanhig or lihitnaheg bitzniyus. The goreim lihistalek shkinam Yisrael. Again, I liked your formulation earlier. I like the Rajba's formulation as well. Tzniyus literally is the formulation, the foundation stone for the presence of the Shechina, the Yisrael. The source from Bilam, otherwise unspecific and puzzling, now assumes, I hope, clear significance. Hatznei Alechet is one of the three indispensable principles of the uniqueness of Klal Yisrael, according to Micha. And the Gemara Makos, Taf Chav Dalet Amud Aleph, tells us, commenting on that pasuk, Ma Hashem Dareshu Imcha Ki Masos Mishpat Vat Chesed Hatznei Alechet Sim Hashem Elokecha Ze Hachnasas Kala Ulevayas Hameis Dvarim she'en darkan la'asos pesina. Precisely in those areas which are public, which give themselves to public expression, and in some cases to trampling upon the sensitivities implied by the concept of tzniyus and privacy. Precisely here we have to be on guard. Kedushas Yisrael and Kedushas Achayim is literally at stake. Thus Yadus is premium on privacy as a dovrish of the Kedusha, as a precondition for the Shechina, is truly unique, I think, among other cultures. Yet, because it flows from the values which include sensitivity to others and to the human condition generally, and reliance upon the responsibility and the communality of others, we're not surprised that all of these manifestations may give way, as applications at least, when they in fact clash or threaten to clash or to threaten equally important values. The very same values which underlie privacy demand protection from others and militate against the exploitation of the right of privacy at the expense of innocent parties. With respect to the family, the dynamic is at once more basic and far more complex. Again, I don't have the time to develop it fully. It should be analyzed more intensively. The davak b'ishto Echad. On the one hand, the intimacy, physical and emotional, between husband and wife demands a relinquishing of some aspects of personal privilege and of some measure of mystique in order to form the existential bond of marriage. And yet, the roots of this mystique and this dignity and this concept of tzniyus is the guarantee of the kind of development that is going to make for a successful relationship between two parties. That relationship indeed is anchored in the previous individual development and continues to be part of the makeup of that relationship. Again, in the Sheva Brachos that we say, we have first Misameach Chasan Vikala, followed only by the final bracha, the bracha Achrita, Misameach Chasan Imakala. The vikala, the respect for the individuality and the uniqueness and the mystique of each partner, is a sine qua non for the im hakala, chasan im hakala, the union between them. And indeed, just read the parshiyos in Bereishis, all the wonderful chazals about the creation of man and woman, different views, du partsufin, a two-headed monster, not a monster, all the different views of Chazal, how this process came about. So Rebbe Bechai speaks at length, what exactly does all this mean? All of the machshavto, what do you mean all of the machshavto? The Baruch Shalom changed his mind. What exactly does it all mean? So I've always understood that the point is that the process was an intentional one. And it was an intentional process meant to accent the different stages and the different status of the components. It was important that first there be an Adam HaRishon, and maybe that he was Zupar Tzufim, or maybe that he wasn't Zupar Tzufim. And only later that there should be this union, and that it should be the Tardema. Again, I'll leave the details for another time. But unquestionably, this whole process is meant to accent the dialectic between individuality, singularity, and union, both of which, each of which, is extremely significant. Moreover, to compensate for the compromise which is necessary to build this union, that demands a need for greater privacy and greater tzniut, A, between husband and wife, in those circumstances where it applies, and more to the point, in the relationship between husband and wife, and in this case, the broader family as well, vis-a-vis the rest of the world. In other words, if it's true that there's a certain breakdown, and breakdown is the wrong word because it's from the Kapila, it's an ideal, that there is a certain development which takes a different form in the relationship of individuals in the context of a marriage or in the creation of a family, and necessarily and ideally within that family structure there is a certain lack of privacy or a certain sharing at least, then it is doubly necessary that within that structure there be a recognition to protect that structure and to protect it from the peering eyes and minds in some cases of the rest of the world. And of course this has a lot to do with standards of arayos for an isha nesua, which otherwise are difficult to understand, but again the greater expectations, the higher stakes, etc., all of this redefines tznius in a very meaningful way. The various forms and sources of privacy, however, as I've indicated, must have definite limits, as do confidentiality, as even does Lashon Hara. We should examine these briefly, even though I started early, I think I might be pushing the time, so I'll try to do it briefly. I need to address also the concept of integrity that results from some of the compromises that need to be made in situations that are less than ideal. The issue of honesty. As noted, many of the exceptions reflect not only a clash between values, but really a struggle to try to determine the internal value itself. What are the internal value limits that reflect and that are consistent with the very basis for the initial rule and requirement for privacy, tznius, kedusha sa'adam, kavod abrios, etc.? We can understand that foundation, we can understand its internal limits. This foundation would be grotesquely compromised, clearly, if these extraordinarily spiritually ambitious values were to be cynically exploited by being applied without qualification or without regard to the innate rights of others. It would be intolerable if privacy could be exploited to victimize others. According to some Rishonim, for example, began earlier with the privacy of the domain. Physical domain, I suggested, has a symbolic parallel. Privacy of domain does not extend to the exclusion, the absolute exclusion, of others' rights. Rabbeinu Tam and Sefer Yashar limits the protection of the domain in debt collection, which I referred to earlier, to the attempt to ensure payment by seizing a mashkon, a pikadon of some sort, prior to the due date of the debt. Once the debt comes due, according to Rabbeinu Tam, I mentioned the Rambam earlier disagrees, but Rabbeinu Tam argues the use of private domain sanctuary as an excuse to prevent piron no longer applies. Rabbeinu Tam's ruling is accepted by some, if not for the Nosha, at least by the Shliach Bezdin, Shulchan Aruch, Siman Tzadi Zayin, Sifta Zion seems to take this position. More striking still is the remarkable position, and even more remarkable formulation, of the Yad Ramah, whose contention is that this protection of the domain does not apply when there's no other alternative to debt collection. The Kofavod Ramah, ki az ha-rachmana shliach bezin shaloli kanes lebeifa shalova, haynu hecha de-efshol el balchov d'shtalume minei ba'anfa achrina. Mikarkoi, umtaltali, aber ki lo efshol el ishtalume minei ba'anfa achrini, ela b'hachi, kagoz, so a mashkachlei, mikarkoi, umtaltali, v'toin d'leisle midi l'farim l'malve, v'malve toin afilu kind of safek, v'yisle mitaltali b'beisei, in other words, there are no other options available. Dina hu d'leil shliach bezin b'beisei. Mashkech midi da v'chazim midina v'mashkunei v'mashkin lef. Afogam, the high milsa lo itma b'gemara behedya, this is the key line, even though there's no real source, there's no explicit gemara that I can invoke, says Rama, to prove this point, v'raboseinu nami lo chazinan da'ayriba, we don't know that that there are precedents, rabbinic precedents for this. Chazinan l'michtav ma d'mistaber lamba v'shim d'lelecha shamayin hi. I write this, says the Raman, we can almost feel it, out of pure conviction, out of sense of conscience. Of course, this is a little snapshot of the halachic process. This is not my topic now. The Yad Ramah was exercising what we would call his Das Torah, or his halachic intuition. The Yad Ramah was the Yad Ramah, and he could exercise this kind of halakhic intuition. And even then, it was circumscribed by the fact that it was not absolutely anchored in sources, but it was a conviction based on his larger view of the halakha, and one which the Ramah projects here. Ramah's license is innovative and radical, especially relative to his view of other Rishonim, but it didn't stop him. Again, the line, Melech HaShemayim, this is not something where manners and other niceties could play a role. He felt strongly, strong conviction. He had to express it and act upon it. But it's all the more powerful and significant precisely because it's based on conviction and not textually anchored, but grounded in halachic intuition. It was simply inconceivable, it comes across from the words, for the Ramah it was inconceivable that the protection of privacy and dignity would come at the expense of someone else's legitimate rights and be cynically exploited to avoid payment and to undermine the foundation of chesed with milvah, which lending money, of course, is in the community. By virtue of this ambitious formulation of the rights of privacy, the implications discussed just a few moments ago, one should perceive hezekiah then as a form of nezek and apply the limiting consequences of this formulation too. Clearly, the innate personal right to set aside in order to prevent damage to others with equivalent innate rights, as I mentioned. Essentially, I am prohibited from behaving, right, conducting myself with absolute freedom in my own property, in emanus, etc., simply because it tramples upon someone else's rights. Or in some cases, when the aggressor and the victim status is evident in favor of those who need greater protection. Let's say I have to do a cost-benefit analysis whether my behavior adversely affects one party more so than the other. Again, the technical issues of hezekiah will have to be reassessed on the basis of the foundation stone which underlies them. The same is true with regard to the Chayim of Benegershim. In the tshuvas of the Chikkei Lev, we find a discussion whether or not a person can open a correspondence, even if it's only a safek, but a safek that there might be information therein about the intent, let's say, to defraud someone else. Even if it's only dinei mamonos, never mind if someone's life is actually at stake. That, of course, would override, that would take precedence. Not take precedence, that's an internal limit of the cheirum of Rebbe Gershom. Both telech rachil ba'amecha and even lashon hara are subject to similar limitations. With respect to Telech Rachil, we find many, many makoros but these do not often withstand conflict with other chiyuvim relating to the conflicting rights of others, particularly when there's some issue of lo samod al dam reyacha at stake, even in its very different manifestation. There's a very famous comment, I don't know where it first appeared, but a very famous comment in the name of Rav Chaim Mivolozhin to this effect, based on smichos in the pasuk itself, lo selech rachil bi'amecha, lo samod al dam reyacha, meaning lo selech rachil bi'amecha is of course a wonderful value and a pervasive one, but one which is limited by Osamar Adam Reyacha. I would simply add, unless he said this as well, in which case Baruch Shekivanti, that it's even part of the same part of the pasuk. According to the Trup, both appear before the Asnachta, implying that it's not just, my twist, not just that if you endanger or encroach upon Osamar Adam Reyacha, that you have the right to be flexible about Moselech Rachil Ba'amecha, but that the reason that you do is because Lo Selech Rachil Bi'amecha itself demands that limitation. It's an internal limitation. Rabbeinu Yonah and Shittim Kubetis Balbatra, that's Lamed Tesla Beis. Others there as well, in the context of Mecha, a person who has to send a, am I already over time? The person who has to register his protest and somebody tries to encroach upon his property, some place to steal his property, but the only way he can do that is essentially to defame to defame the person who's trying to steal his property. Does that violate Lashon Hara or Motzi Shemra? Very fascinating discussions, again beyond our time limit, for Ben Yonah and other Rishonim discussed. Or for example, the Shliach Bezdin, Marimari Kottendaf, Tazayin Rebeis, notes that, you know, the Shliach Bezdin may have to come back and report all the invective that was spewed upon him by this unwilling defendant, this fellow who doesn't want to show up in court. You know, he has to report exactly what took place between them and why, what he said, and on what basis he refused to attend. That might mean that he has to relate Lashon Hara. The Gemara says, that's not Lashon Hara. That's the job of the Shliach Bezdin. That's part of the court system, etc. Obviously, these limitations apply not only when you impinge on other formal legal processes, but quite possibly any time when someone else is endangered, even when the other person's position is going to be adversely affected. The Gemara in Nida, Samachalif Amin Aleph, speaks about Gedalia being criticized for not taking seriously the rumor of a threat to his life, dismissing it simply as Lashon Hara. Gedalia is blamed for the consequences. He's the one who suffered the consequences. Habor asher shlich sham Yishmael is kol pigrei anashim asher ikah b'yad Gedalia v'chi Gedalia haragol halo Yishmael haragol ela mitoch shehayalo lachush la'atzaf Yochanan ben Korach v'lachosh ma'ale alav ha'katuv ki'ilu haragol Amar Rava ha'ilish nabisha afalpi delekibulei lo mibay. You shouldn't accept Lashon Hara. Sometimes you should consider it, be warned, take steps to protect yourself, to safeguard against it. Obviously, the line here is critical, the details are important, etc. Several Makoros demonstrate that supplies at least with equal force to one who has the capacity to warn someone else that his life, that his livelihood is in danger, that he has suspicions, etc. But again, you obviously have to be extremely careful in implementing it. The Chavetz Chaim and others apply this even more liberally to monetary losses, to psychological suffering, and certainly to physical danger. They note that Lo Samar Al Dam Reyacha probably is not limited to Dinei Nefashos, at least in some Makoros, the Rambam and Sefer Mitzvos, at least in one place, may apply to financial loss, etc. The obligation to warn others of the questionable ethics, for example, of a potential business partner, or potential fraud, or serious psychological or medical complications in shiduchim, these are discussed at great length by Poskim, Chavetz Chaim, in his again everything's Chavetz Chaim's Shmiras Haloshon is this Musa sefer, and you know it's a very fascinating sefer. He deals with extremely practical issues and in a very very complex way, and in a way I might add that reflects unbelievable mental energy to pin down the Makoros and to go way beyond previous discussions, you can see the extent to which this was something that that moved the Chafetz Chaim, and it's a matter of life and death, and the energy that he poured into translating very general principles and very vague Gemaras into very specific principles and rules and applications, some of which other poskim might argue with. But that mental energy is incredibly impressive, I would even add, incredibly inspiring. Indeed, the Chafetz Chaim encourages investigations into shiduchim and to partnerships and relationships of all sorts, obviously within reason, but on the basis of themes like Durachah, Darche Noam, etc. Again, accenting that this is an internal theme. Presumably, this implies that internal considerations and the limits of even Lashon Hara, certainly Rechilus, etc., certainly basic privacy, dictate the allowance. These are not gratuitous, obviously, or malicious. They're not gossip. They all serve to enhance, safeguard the innate rights of potential victims. Like Michal, like Shliach Beis Din, these would not be defined as overriding situations where you reject one principle because of another, but again, as internal limits within those values themselves. Confidentiality specifically is examined in these contexts, even where we're talking about breaches of privacy. Most poskim argue, for example, that Chovas HaGadas Eidos transcends any promise I alluded to in the outset or commitment of confidentiality. Even a shvua generally is not perceived as an obstacle, though it can become entangled with, again, Nishvalabatel, Mefurash, Prati, Klali, etc. Maybe you need a Taras Nadarim or a shvua. Anything that is drabanan or less could be problematic. There are all sorts of particular limits on this, but all things being equal, many poets can say that the chiyuv of Haggadah Seidus, to disclose what you know for the benefit of one who needs it, that overrides confidentiality in most cases. Rabbi Nachum Mewurzburg, quoting the Tshuvas of Rabbi Yaakov Weil, and the Yenivikos Busha, obligated testimony despite a commitment to preserve confidences on the basis of Divrei Arab, Divrei Talmud, Divrei Nishomim. Rabbi Yaakov Weil himself, in one of the Tshuvas, suggests the need for litigants to release, just try to get yourself released from the Shvua, but again, assumes that all things being equal, this would not be an obstacle to testimony. Taz and others in Choshen Mishpat and in Chafkas assume this as well, although not everybody agrees. The Ma'arik in his Tshuva Simin Kofyud takes it as axiomatic that a commitment would never excuse the violation of someone else's rights. Never would a commitment to one party prevent the observance of takanos or chramim that have importance to the entire community. Even if the particular takana or chram in question was enacted after the commitment was made. He's very expansive about this theme of not abusing the privilege of secrecy and confidentiality and privacy at the expense of other parties. And this view is in fact codified in Shulchan Aruch. The Ramban, Yerodeus, and Reish Chavches speak Lamed Gimel, Beis Yosef, earlier, etc. Again, the Simon Reish Lamed Tes, Steve Zion, Yeshomim, Shanizba, Shalom, Galot, Chaver, Dover, Shia, Silenu, Mene Hefstein, Havanizba, Labatala, Nitzvah, Enochal. The Kolmakom nearly, the Yeshla, Hatira, Tchila, the Chake, Yigalelo, the Loadifi, Mashuhu, Medrish Chachamim. Or, Reish Chavches, which I mentioned before, Afil Nizba, Le Zedover, Shalom, Galoso, While the Pisrei Tshuva speaks about whether or not he has lost his kashus la'edos anyway, should be an irony, a cruel irony, but as I say, the basic impulse of most Rishonim is that there are many conditions under which one can violate this kind of confidence. Some of the more modern posts can suggest that if we're dealing with a kind of, again, a shvua klalit, a kolol klali, like a Hippocratic oath, etc., there it might not be so simple. There the issue of Nishba Levatos and Mitzvah may not neutralize the Shavua itself. Of course, as I alluded to earlier, and I just want to repeat it, there's an additional kind of halachic cost-benefit calculation involved in these kind of professional commitment issues. as noted. In other words, you have to weigh, in addition to the narrow issue, what impact it has on medicine and on psychology and things of that sort. And it's extremely difficult to make decisions, but these are issues that have to be assessed. We have precedents for dealing with issues on either a narrow or a broader level when it comes to other issues of halakha. What is the relationship between kavod abrios and afrushe meisura? What are the limits of chatei, kadesh tzake, chavercha, etc.? So that even if one can come to the conclusion that per se it's legitimate to override confidentiality, one still has to consider some of the other issues. The issue of nesira comes up in this connection as well. The only way to protect other innocent parties is to turn someone over to a secular authority, then the preponderant view of the poskim is that one is entitled to do so. Obviously, again, the particular circumstances need to be addressed. The question of personal integrity, though, also needs to be discussed. What if a person has to violate a confidence because of these overriding, even internal considerations? In other words, the heart-wrenching decision, once it's been reached, demands that you break the confidence in question. Does this reflect some blight on your honesty or on your sincerity? I think it's clear, in light of the analysis, if we're talking about an internal limit, that the answer is clearly not. But I'd just like to add, since the hour is very late, so I'll try to finish with this, that integrity is really the foundation, in my opinion, of honesty. It just so happens in 99% of cases, and this is the way it should be, that integrity is served by truth-telling. But the fact is that the word emes and the concept of emes, especially when we use the concept of emes with respect to the Ribono Shel Olam, Chosomo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu emes, we speak of his bottom line, his signature principle being emes, it's clear that we speak of much more than truth-telling. And occasionally, that also ironically allows us to transcend truth-telling and even to allow the statement of falsehoods as a function of emes. Emes, apparently, is a reference not so much to telling the truth per se, but to integrity. In 99 or 98% of cases, that also plays itself out, manifests itself, in telling the truth. In very rare cases, where other halakhic principles are involved, integrity, chosomo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu emes, demands that we formulate things in a more ambiguous way. Of course, what comes to mind is the issue of shalom bayis, which was, I think, supposed to be my original topic. Shalom bayis, the Rabbanu Shalom himself, we wouldn't say the word lie, lied is too strong a word, told a falsehood, didn't formulate things in the most accurate or precise way, right, in order to facilitate shalom bayis. One shouldn't see this as a breach of honesty or truth, otherwise how could it be chosomo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu emes? One should see this as an internal adjustment for the sake of what drives truth-telling, emes. Titein emes le'Yaakov, according at least to the interpretation of Rabbeinu Bechai, who says it refers to Yaakov Avinu, those who partially do not, but it's remarkable that we give the midah, according to Rabbeinu Bechai, of emes to Yaakov, titein le'Yaakov emes, when this ishtam is the, you know, perpetrated the single greatest, on the surface, biblical hoax of all. But of course, again, a proper understanding of Yaakov's behavior establishes that you don't just walk in a vacuum and assess his hoax. We need to know who he was, we need to know what he was up against, we need to know what motivated him. He was the one who deserved the Bechorah, he was the one who felt the measure of responsibility for continuity or for creation of Kal Yisrael. Again, all the Rabbanim, all the Drashos, so know it even better than I. But the point is that one, if you take the wider view of Yaakov Avinu, Yaakov was operating against his own essential character as an Ishtam, as Titen Emes LeYaakov. And even then, of course, the Medrash and Chazal make much of the fact that he didn't technically lie, right? There are ways to read the psukim which establish that he actually told the truth. So the question arises, and therefore, he misled his father. Is a lie in the words, or is it in the impression? Clearly it's the impression. I think the point of Chazal, though, is to establish that even if Yaakov Avinu, for internal reasons, for the reasons of integrity, for the reasons of the integrity of Klal Yisrael, had to take drastic steps, steps that were counterintuitive to his own nature, even as he did this, he could not do it but in a way which was consistent with that nature. For his own standards, he had to formulate things in a manner which reflected some level of truth. Instead of seeing this the way it's normally seen, Yaakov Avinu perpetuated a hoax, and he relied on a technicality that he told the truth. The way I perceive it is exactly the opposite. Yaakov Avinu did what he had to do, and with all the midrashim, some are critical, some are see it in approving terms. I'm taking the approving stance, obviously, at the moment. Yaakov Avinu did what he did. His formulation, his linguistic formulation, was a function of the extent to which he was uncomfortable even taking these steps when he had to. The Gemara in Shavuot, Daf Lamed, speaks about Midbar Sheker Tirchak. I have till 6:30. I have one more there. Midbar Sheker Tirchak is very fascinating. I won't go into the cases, but it's a very fascinating Gemara. The Gemara says on Midbar Sheker Tirchak, on the surface, is a reference to lying. If you look at the cases, several of the cases have nothing to do with telling the truth. It's all, in my opinion, all about integrity. Behaving in a manner which is consistent with who and what you should be. Even if technically you're never involved in one falsehood, maybe not even misleading people. Simply to behave with integrity is the true concept of Midbar Sheker Tirchak. I think that this is reflected in many other issues as well. Let me just conclude, since my time is already up. I spoke for much of tznius and privacy, and the concept of privacy in terms of and with reference to Tzelem Elokim. It's evident also that I've tried to accent, but not given enough time to it, that there are special aspects of privacy that pertain bein ish v'ishto and bein mishpachto l'kol ha'olam. And I think that this is true, and I think we live in an age in which this is often jeopardized and overlooked. Certainly the whole area of tznius as relates to women, called kvud bas melach pnima, accents precisely what Rabinoval began with, this theme of dignity and kvod ha'adam and tzelem elokim and gedarim shel Yisrael and the hashras hashchina, as the Tshuvas HaRashba reflects it. But at the same time, not only bein ish, I say the ishto, and not only bein kol ish, the kol ha'olam, but this special idea of the bulwark of the family is something which is very much in jeopardy, I think, in our era. I think it's a particular issue for Rabbanim, and I just throw it out on the table since my time is up about 10 seconds ago. I throw it on the table. I think that Rabbanim in the field in particular, and here I speak more as a Ben Harav, not a community rabbi, although my position obviously as well, I am a public, have a public role and a public figure. But I think that the role of the rabbinic family is extremely important and extremely crucial, because I have to tell you that in communities, the rabbi is in the spotlight and his family is in the spotlight as well. And the ability to balance the concept of tznius in this sense and privacy, to protect one's family and to keep a coherent relationship between the members of that family, at the same time sharing with and being makariv a community and sometimes the broader Klal Yisrael, that is a formidable challenge indeed. I think sometimes we're so idealistic that we focus very much on our communal responsibilities, as we should. But sometimes, clearly, the casualty is the family. And it's my contention that ultimately, if we make that extraordinary effort to preserve the inner sanctum of the family, that eventually, internally, that will be not only the best way for us to proceed, but ultimately the best way to project ourselves for the rest of Klal Yisrael, and to be effective Rabbanim as well. Thank you very much.
Once again, I think we've been fed it with really a treasure of Myron McComos and insight. Unfortunately, it's been taped, and I see from Rabbi Rosenzweig's notes, maybe this will eventually be published, because this is something that needs to be reviewed and digested, because there is an incredible amount of information that I think has wide applicability to many, many different things. So we like to thank Rabbi Rosenzweig for really an incredible presentation, and I think we have Rabbi Shulman some time for questions. And we have time for questions?
Always. Especially when my wife is the one raising her hand.
Go ahead.
Rosh Kollel touched on different issues in terms of Shidduchim, in terms of responsibility. In the case of, let's say, for example, a lawyer, or a rabbi for that matter, who is meeting with the congregant and certain information is divulged, which in fact could be have quite serious consequences. It doesn't matter if the person's a murderer,
right.
They're not allowed to divulge. How does it work with a bottom or a lawyer or accountants? I mean,
I think that's an excellent point, and that's really one of the things that I've been trying to project. I began by noting that privacy is almost passé in the society in which we live. Certainly, the notion of tenure, and yet you have this extraordinary professional confidentiality, and I think that's what you're reflecting. And the priest Lahavdil is an excellent example of it. One of the things I've tried to develop, I feel strongly, is the halacha does not extend confidentiality all the way to that level. There is a strong notion of confidentiality to the extent that one feels that he can manage, and sometimes it's a judgment call, and that's where either being a trained professional in addition to being a rav, whether it be having psychological training or just having excellent intuition or having somebody to consult, all of these things that come into play. But where one believes that he can manage the situation and that it will not redound adversely to someone else, while at the same time maintaining confidence, then I think one should make every effort to do so, per se, and also because we want people to feel comfortable to speak to Rabbanim, to share their problems, and if there's not this sense of security that all things being equal, the Rav is somebody who can be trusted and who will keep a confidence, then we'll lose that. That's what I meant by the broader problem. At the same time, I think when one feels that something really is out of control, when there is a possibility that some other Tzelem Elokim is at stake, certainly on the Dina Nefashos level, I think in some cases even on the Dina Mamonos level, although that's obviously much more flexible, I think under these circumstances, Halacha asserts quite clearly, Lo Selech Rachil Bamecha, but Lo Samor Bamecha. You've been sworn to secrecy, but there is a chiyuv hagadas edus, and when that chiyuv applies, you should try again to work around both and not to violate either if you don't have to. But when it becomes a choice, we do not accept the priest's confidentiality.
That's with
regard
to love. What was that with
regard
to, let's say, a lawyer?
All things being equal, there's no such thing as halacha that applies to rabbanim and not to profession, right? So all things being equal, what we're talking about is halacha's view of the normative Jewish obligation. All things being equal, a lawyer, a doctor, a psychologist, a rav, it really doesn't make a difference. I think practically, it might very much make a difference. And that gets back to the other issue. Namely, what are the norms of society? How are they going to be affected from a spiritual standpoint? And this is what you consider to be beneficial to society.